And you've joined together with other writers in fiercely condemning what is happening. What do you think needs to happen now?
I think what needs to happen now is, first of all, awareness. I thank you for covering it, because the general U.S. media in general has been very silent about it. And so for people to really inform themselves about what's happening, to write to your congresspeople, and also we are subsidizing, as Americans, the sugar industry in the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic gets the largest ration of sugar subsidies in cut to the U.S. So we are all implicated in this. So make sure that your voice is heard. Make sure you call your congresspeople, because lives depend on it.
We want to thank you very much, Edwidge Dondekut, for joining us. Acclaimed Haitian-American novelist, her latest book, Claire of the Sea Light. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and an engagement editor in social media. Find out more at democracynow.org. They're both full-time jobs here in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aramati, Nirmin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with guest host Per Fogering. Today's guest is Professor Emeritus at Lewis and Clark Graduate School of Education and Counseling, Dr. Zahir Wahab. We'll talk about the current situation in Afghanistan.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be the sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 2nd through the 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. The Blues Festival includes cruises like the Blue Bayou Cruise, the Rock the Boat Dance Cruise, Drifting Blues Cruise, and the Sail On Sister Cruise, as well as after-hour performances featuring Galactic, Charmaine Neville, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, and the Paladins. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/Waterfront Blues Festival 2015.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor for ALEC Expo's film screening and workshop on June 18th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. ALEC, the American Legislators Exchange Council, is a corporate-directed organization which writes model legislation for state legislatures around the nation that is beneficial to multinational corporations. Secretive corporate-directed and funded organizations like ALEC undermine the principles of citizens participating in democratic processes. ALEC Expose explains how ALEC functions, who is involved, and how to fight back to promote democratic, non-corporate values. Again, that's ALEC Expose, June 18th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Food Wars 8, hosted by Clinton Street Theater. This annual music and comedy festival is also a food drive and will feature entertainment from August in Blue, Bad Habit, Tragedy, Boomer, Belinda Carroll, and more. Again, that's Food Wars 8, Sunday, June 21st at 5 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fargring. I'm filling in for the Wednesday morning call-in show. And we got a special guest. We are part of the KABU family, Professor Zahir Wahab, who has been in Afghanistan for a while now. And he's back here in Portland visiting us. And we'd like to welcome Zahir back to town again.
Thank you, Per, for having me. And it's nice to be with you here.
So you've been you've been working on a big education project in Afghanistan. Is that right?
Yes, well, as you know, I have been going back every year since 2002, mm-hmm. Spending a semester or two semesters. First, acting as advisor to the Ministry of Higher Education, and then teaching in two programs at Kabul University and Kabul Education University. And for the last year and a half, I have been working full-time with the American University of Afghanistan. And what I have been doing most recently is to design and teach in and direct a master's degree program for community college, teacher training community colleges from throughout the country. We just had our commencement on May 17th and graduated most of the students. And what this is, it's a program that was funded by the World Bank and sponsored by the Ministry of Education, but implemented by the American University of Afghanistan. We brought people, or the ministry brought people from every single one of the 34 provinces, from every one of the 42 teacher training college, two-year teacher training colleges from throughout the country. We had 320 students, 36% of whom were women. Mm-hmm. And so my job was to design the program, write the syllabi, hire 44 adjunct faculty over the last 18 months and manage the program on a daily basis and also teach in it. And it has been a great success, a wonderful program. Very, very challenging because people did come from all over the country with representing all kinds of ethnicities, religions, languages, ideas, ideologies, and worldviews. It was quite a challenge. I can say it was perhaps the most difficult, challenging, and yet gratifying thing I have done.
How do they interact when they're all together?
Not nicely initially. Uh-huh. I have to say we had initially, like a year ago, March, we had men who said, I refuse to learn from a woman in the classroom. Mm. We had men who insisted that women sit in the back. We had people, men and women, who resisted any kind of a critical, logical, evidential look at the world. We had people who were highly, not just patriotic and nationalistic, but in fact xenophobic. So we had the whole gamut. We had people who were very smart, very progressive, very aware. And then we had people who literally, as if they came from, the mountains in the caves. But by the end of the program, we did a massive survey, end of the program evaluation, and the feedback was just tremendous. I mean, we really did turn lives around. Mm-hmm. So if we could go on doing this for maybe four or five cohorts, I think we would have made a big difference on the entire education system in the country.
So then these graduates, they go back to their homes and their communities, and they become teachers.
Yes.
In community colleges and there, community or high schools, or
no? What these community two-year community colleges are? Mm-hmm. They train teachers for first through ninth grade, mm-hmm. and our program was designed for people who train those people who teach in the community colleges, and so they all went back to their respective community colleges and provinces and would resume teaching or assuming leadership positions.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So they were teacher trainers, and they all had their bachelor's degrees in various fields. Our program was, to upgrade their knowledge, skills, and credentials so they can be more effective and more, useful.
So will this program continue? I mean, say you can four or five more cohorts and you'll have sort of a self-sustaining thing going.
Yes.
Is that Is that likely to happen?
Yes. The understanding is that this will be a multi-year program funded by the World Bank and or other organizations like the USAID or Canadians and so forth. But at the American University of Afghanistan, I think I can say, perhaps is the only university in the country that looks and functions more or less like a real university. There are 32 public institutions of higher learning and more than 100 private institutions of higher learning in Afghanistan now, enrolling about 200,000 people. But it's understood that the American University is the place. If you want to get a real, decent, quality education, you go to the American University of Afghanistan.
How long has that university been there?
It was founded in 2006, and it's growing. And today it was founded, the first commencement had 52 students. This year we graduated perhaps about 500 students. And so we have 2,500 students now graduate and undergraduate. And then the university has satellite programs in two other provinces, in Herat, Kandahar, and Mazar-e-Sharif, where they offer vocational workshops and ESL classes. So it's a new university. And I can say that maybe 65 to 70% of the faculty are international, mostly American. The administration, of course, is American. But the staff are mostly Afghans. And although it's a very attractive target for insurgents, and we have had threats. We have had more lockdowns this year than I can remember. We evacuated all the internationals exactly a year ago. And a week ago, I got an email from the chief of staff at the university saying there will be two helicopter landings tonight on campus, one at 5:30 and one at 8:30. Please don't be alarmed. What she was saying is that they're rehearsing for evacuation, just in case, because Kabul is a very dangerous, very violent city, and the State Department advisory late last month said all foreign establishments, all foreigners are targets, and you need to be careful.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a little bit, but I'd like to ask you what, this American University is, since 2006, what was there before that?
Nothing.
Nothing at all. Was there? And were there no universities?
Oh, there were universities. Of course, there were universities. The Kabul University is about 85 years old, the oldest university. It used to be one of the best university in the region. In fact, foreign students used to come and study at Kabul University because it had such a, high standards and excellent professors and so forth. So there were, of course, universities, maybe 25 public universities and just a few private. But the then Minister of Higher Education, Dr. Faiz, who is an Afghan-American PhD from the University of Arizona, and I was his advisor at the time, and we said we were not happy with what we saw in higher ed and pre-collegiate education. So we said what this country needs is a model liberal arts institution such as, say, Lewis and Clark College or Reed College or the American University of Beirut or the American University of Cairo. So we started putting a charter together, a program together, and we went to the president of the country, and he gave us about 60 acres of land in a very nice area of Kabul for 100 years lease. And the charter was approved, and then went to the American Embassy and USAID and got some money together. And so that's how it started, because our idea was that we wanted to have a good liberal arts institution, which was lacking. And, of course, there's an explosion of education, both private and public. You know, you talk about 8 million school kids now and 200,000 higher ed kids. But this is a country where 70% of the population is under 25. There's a tremendous need and demand for education. The government does not have the resources to deliver quality universal education. And so the American University is sort of the beacon. it's the model because, you know, it has internet, it has good facilities, it has good faculty, we take attendance, we don't accept bribes, there's no corruption. And so anybody who can, and 80% of the students have some kind of a scholarship. Anyone who can wants to be associated and affiliated with the AUAF.
Well, what is the situation like sort of in the country, in Kabul right now? I mean, in the general situation, not just education. I mean, there's fighting going on. The Taliban is back. We hear that Islamic State is in there now. I mean, it's... What are things like?
I think I can say the country is in a profound, multifaceted crisis. The State Department advisory says it all. After 14 years nearly of enormous, massive U.S.-NATO presence and $1 trillion and thousands of lives and more than 200,000 American dead Afghans killed, according to the Physician for Social Responsibility and Brown University. The overall situation is, I think you can really say the country is on the brink. So politically, there was an election second round exactly a year ago as we speak. But the problem with the outcome is that, you have a multi-headed, government where you have several, in effect, presidents instead of one president. Remember that the first round took place in April of election for the presidency. In April of 2014, that was unacceptable because there was massive fraud, everyone saw it. And then the election went to a second round in June. In fact, it was June 16, I think, or 17 of last year. That also was unacceptable to both sides, and Dr. Abdullah and Dr. Ashraf Ghani. And there were rumors of a civil war. And there were rumors of a coup d'etat and the country was really on the brink, and there was a lot of tension and a lot of fear and anxiety. And so John Kerry, our illustrious Secretary of State, landed in Kabul and came up with this incredible idea. So he said, all right, we'll give the presidency to Ashraf Ghani, but we will make Dr. Abdullah, the other candidate, as chief executive officer. Well, this is something, a position that does not exist in the Afghan constitution. People did not expect it. That's not what people voted for. But he persuaded them. I don't know what he promised them and what carrots he used. So he created this two-headed state in a way, and each of them then have, vice presidents or assistants. So people talk about having, instead of one president, seven presidents. It took the country from then, June of last year, until just about a month ago for the government to put a cabinet together. Because these two individuals, they don't like each other. They're different in ethnicity. They're still campaigning. They hate each other. They undermine each other. And so nothing gets done. In other words, the government has been paralyzed. No wonder, they were able to put a cabinet together after 11 months when the Constitution says it should be done too. So politically, and then they signed this, by the National Security Agreement, with the United States a year ago. But there's no security. There's no peace. So there's war going on all over the place. This year was the most intense, the bloodiest, and the most violent by any measure. And now ISIS have arrived or have been manufactured, which we can talk about later. Economically, 70% of the government's operating budget and 90% of the development budget comes from abroad. Half of the population is unemployed or underemployed. More than half of the people live on, say, a dollar a day, and nothing gets done. The country still can't make pencils. The social situation, the institutions have broken down, and it seems like nothing works. More importantly, I think, no one seems to have any faith in or believe in the country. Anyone who can try is leaving the country, and anyone who can is taking their money out. So that's the situation.
Do these two presidents, do they represent different political positions, or are they just is it a personal issue? I mean,
it's personal. The position, you know, they're both very smart. I have met both of them in the past, not recently.
Well, one of them worked for the World Bank or something.
Yes,
didn't he?
You know, Ashraf Ghani has a PhD from Columbia University. Mm-hmm. You know, he went to the American University of Beirut. Has worked with the World Bank. He's sort of a quote technocrat,
okay.
And he indeed is a very smart man. You know, he has a vision for the country. He has plans, he has ideas, he has strategies, he works very hard, he's brilliant, he's very eloquent. He's a Pashtun. The other guy, Dr. Abdullah, who's a dentist, I think, by training, was the spokesperson for the late Ahmad Shah Massoud, also very worldly. You know, he was Minister of Foreign Affairs in the Karzai government, you know, has seen the world, it's very smart, very, but one represents one set of the, in Afghanistan, everything eventually boils down to ethnicity in your language and religion. Mm-hmm. And very few people manage to transcend those identities. And so one represents the Pashtuns and the technocrats. The other represents the Tajiks, the Panjshiris, the Hazaras, et cetera, et cetera. So, and it's also personal. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people did as much slinging as they could during the campaigns, and you can almost see that it's going on. And under these conditions, you know, and the country needs a good functioning government, but the government is broken. It's factionalized, and it's a failed state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think this is Per Fagering. I'm doing Wednesday Talk Radio. My guest is Professor Zahir Wahab, who's just back from Afghanistan. And if people want to call in, the number is 231-8187. So anyway, do we have a call? James on the phone. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, you're on the air.
All right. So I have a question. I mean, I guess, I don't know. I don't know all the real technical stuff going on with the war in the Middle East. I just, you know, I know what I hear from you guys and maybe a few other things, but like, How is the maybe you've gone over it, maybe I missed it, but how is the education system, is it getting better over there, as even though the war is just kind of dragging on? I mean, it's been like 14, 15 years now, so.
Yes, you can say that in Afghanistan, you know, we will talk about Afghanistan. When I first went there in 2002, March, April of 2002, there were just four or five universities, government universities, with perhaps, 10,000 students. There were about maybe a million or a million and a half kids going to first through 12th grade. Quality and quantity, obviously very limited. Today, you have 200,000 university students and maybe 8 million kids going to schools, first through 12th grade. There are 32 government institutions of higher learning and maybe more than 100 private institutions of higher learning. And you have a lot of private schools. So, in terms of numbers, there has been a massive expansion and increase in the education system. But if you look at it, for example, the average budget for a school kid by the government is $60. And on university education, the average expenditure or budget, government budget, is about $400 per student. So in other words, in terms of quality, a school kid gets $60 worth of education in a year, and the university student gets $400 worth of education. You can figure that out, you know, our expenditures here, and, you know, you can pay that much for a book. The problem now is that half of the schools have no buildings, and the school year is very short because there's war going on, there are floods, and so forth. And also, only maybe 20% of the teachers are really, really qualified. So you have, increase in numbers, but the quality, you know, the curriculum, the textbooks, the teachers, the teaching methods, these are very, very limited. And, you know, you have 200,000 students in higher ed, but that's only less than 2% of the age bracket who should be in college. So that's the way things are. People go to school or university without learning much. And then there's no work for them. The problem also is that when people graduate from the university, there's no work. And so they either resort to try to leave the country or resort to drugs, you know. And we have 3 million Afghans using drugs. This is the U.S. State Department. Mm. Because for young people, you know, there's no work, there's no money, there's no future, there's no education, there's no hope. And the only thing they can do is to resort to these distractions.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds
pretty bad, doesn't it?
Terrible.
Well,
yeah.
That's how it is. And you can compare that situation with, say, the education system here, Oregon or in this country, although our education also is worse than many other countries in the world.
Well, thanks for your
call. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for answering my question. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your call.
All right.
Do we have any other caller on the line? Or Don is on the line. Good morning, Don. Can't quite hear you.
Hello?
Oh, you're on the air.
Oh, I am. There's something wrong with this Obama phone. It's kind of dim. Listen, I got a question. There's been a rumor that the CIA is heavily involved in the Afghan poppy trade. In the context of Uncle Sam peddling heroin globally, is there any validity to that?
I honestly don't know if the CIA or any branch of the U.S. government or other NATO members is directly involved in either the growing, manufacturing, or export of drugs. But we know this, that the ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, and the U.S. Embassy, the CIA, including everyone knows about the magnitude of this problem, poppies. Afghanistan, this year was a bumper year. Remember when the Taliban were in power before 2001, drug production almost was brought down to a zero. They almost eliminated the poppy industry. But now Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's heroin. 90%. And we also know that the United States, different branches of government there know full well. You know, all you need to do is read the reports by SIGAR, S-I-G-A-R. And this is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, John Sopko, and 200 of his workers from the United States to track American money in Afghanistan and to see what's happening. And, you know, John Sopko would say, this is a scandal. This is a crime. You know, this is a tragedy to allow this amount of drugs produced and, marketed and so forth. I remember a 60 Minutes documentary where Steve Croft, I think was his name, I don't watch it now. He's walking with this American general in the poppy fields in Helmand. And Steve turns to this general, American general, and says, "General, what is this? You know, you can see this going on." And the general says to Steve Crofts, he says, "Yes, we know, but we have to work with these guys." I think the big mistake in general has been that the U.S. Occupation invasion forces in Afghanistan initially and to this date work with some of the worst elements in Afghanistan, with criminals, traffickers, drug dealers, warlords, assassins, etc., because they help the American presence, the American occupation and invasion of the country. And so if the CIA or, you know, the Pentagon or anybody, embassy, if they're not involved actively, they certainly have full knowledge of this problem, and they certainly have the full information about the drug kingpins and the international and Afghan mafia who are involved in the drug industry and who send heroin to Portland.
Well, you know, this bumper crop of poppy turns into opium, gets sold over most of the world.
Yeah.
Now, that money's got to go somewhere. It doesn't stay in Afghanistan, I'm sure.
In fact, yes.
And so it gets laundered by banks. And once it's laundered, it becomes clean money, quote, clean money, and gets invested and winds up who knows where, Wall Street maybe. I mean, it's just the, you know, you see the same thing in Mexico, you know. I mean, some of the biggest banks there were laundering money, and so.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. I was just reading a report, actually. Let's say the Afghan farmer or the landowner, especially the farmer and the hundreds of thousands of people who then work in the poppy fields, you know, they would make, let's say, $10 out of $100. The $90 is divided then between the local mafia, the Afghan drug lords, and the international. So I was reading, and it said, for example, this $100 worth of poppies in Afghanistan would be worth more than $100,000 in the international market. Mm. So narcotics are a third of the Afghan GDP, between a third and a half of the Afghan GDP. But internationally, it's about $80 billion worth of industry. Now, you know, you, as you point out, Pearl, this is right. People who don't hide this money in their mattresses, I mean, it has to be banked someplace or invested or reinvested. So certainly, many world governments and many world intelligence agencies must know where the money goes and which bank it is deposited and how it's laundered and recycled. The way it's done in Afghanistan by the local drug lords and so forth is to... there's an explosion of massive buildings, you know, apartments, McMansions, they call them narco mansions and so forth, and also money going to Dubai, cash. It is estimated that every day about $10 million leave Afghanistan through the airport, the Afghan National Airport in Kabul, for other countries. So certainly people know this, but nothing is being done.
Yeah. What about, you know, the drugs themselves? I would imagine, you know, Russia has a pretty serious drug problem.
Yes.
A lot of that come from Afghanistan. I mean, it's close by.
Yes. Iran has a very serious, Iran, Pakistan, Russia, and then the rest of the world. And as we said, 90% of that heroin is produced in Afghanistan.
There's a lot of traveling then, doesn't it?
Yes. Unfortunately, in Afghanistan, too, and this is, again, the UN and U.S. State Department figures most recently, actually, some 3 million Afghans use drugs, hard drugs. And 1.5 million of them, including women and children, are addicted. And you can see this in broad daylight in Kabul. Drive on almost any road and look under any bridge or anywhere where there's a shelter, and you see clusters of men, unfortunately, and some of them young men, you know.
How do they afford
shooting.
It? How do they afford it?
Through crime, or they sell whatever they have. They steal, they commit other crimes, prostitution, you know, sell their children. There are always stories in the press in Afghanistan where a drug addict would actually sell his little daughter or enslave his son or, in fact, pimp for his own wife and his own children, because most of the addicts are men and the dealers. But you see them in broad daylight. And heroin is as cheap, as accessible, as easy to get in Afghanistan as you'd be getting a bottle of water here.
Wow. Okay, this is coming up this morning on KBOO is at 9 on Political Perspectives. We have an economic update with host Richard Wolff. And he is interviewing Professor Sonia Sayers about the end of free universities in the U.S. Wow, we talked this education morning here. KBOO is always in education.
Yes, yes.
And at 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein speaks to the president of the United Farm Workers about a major victory in the struggle to protect the farm workers. And he also hosts an encore presentation of a feature on the farm workers' struggle in Baja California. And the TPP is the stalled in Congress. What does that mean? So that's all coming up on Flashpoints. And at 11, the food show explores the world of grains. And the guests include Stephen Yaffa, author of Grain of Truth, The Real Case for and Against Wheat and Gluten, Chef Kathy Wims, and Dr. David Perlmutter, author of Grain Brain, and more recently, Brainmaker. So I want to thank KBOO members for supporting KBOO Community Radio. And if you're not a member, it's easy to become one. Just go to KBOO FM and click on the donate today. And so I will continue now. This is Parafogring. I've been doing a Wednesday call-in show, and my guest is Professor Zahir Wahab, talking all about his recent adventures in Afghanistan.
Yes, it is quite an adventure, Per. Yes.
And I think, do we have another caller? Karen is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Professor, and I apologize, you may have already discussed this. I unfortunately didn't get to hear the whole program, but I wanted to know something about what has happened to the infrastructure in Afghanistan because of the war, and also how many people have been killed because of the war, and how many refugees have been created. And I'll hang up and listen on the radio for the answer. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. Good questions. We will start with the casualties. Again, Brown University just issued a report about 2 weeks ago, and the Physician for Social Responsibility also issued a report on the casualties, the Afghan casualties. And Brown University thinks that more than 110,000 Afghans have been killed since 2001. But the Physician for Social Responsibility believe that about 210,000 Afghans have been killed. The UN figures, and these they began doing this in 2009 to keep tracks of the casualties, but the UN report, UNAMA, United Nations Association Mission for Afghanistan, also issued a report just most recently. This year has been the bloodiest since 2001. So far, more than 1,100 civilians have been killed, and about 4,000 military, the Afghan security forces, have been killed. We will never know how many people got hurt or how many people were killed indirectly by, let's say, destroying their homes or their crops or their animals or whatever. So, and you know, how many people have been maimed, and the healthcare system is falling apart because of lack of funds and because the foreigners can't quite, get to places. So the casualties, the damage has been enormous. And I think we also should consider the psychic casualties. I can say this now, that there are probably very few people in Afghanistan, men and or women or children or anybody, who has not been traumatized. Maybe 10% of the population. Who have not been traumatized, but you can see it. I mean, I can see in my own encounters with grown men and women who fall apart very easily. Grown men and women who are afraid, who are anxious, who have lost somebody. I mean, I would be sitting, for example, in class at the American University of Afghanistan, and someone gets a phone call saying your brother was just killed. So the human costs, real, indirect, and the psychic costs have been enormous. And, you know, it will take years for a generation perhaps to recover from this. In terms of infrastructure, the big mistake in Afghanistan was that from day one, October 7, 2001, to this moment, the focus has been on, quote, counterinsurgency. Remember David Petraeus, the general, our national hero, almost president, and now is trying to stay out of jail, which says something about the justice system here, which is, just give
could
him
use
credit.
Could use improving.
Yes, could use improvement. So the focus was on, quote, fighting the bad guys, the insurgency and so forth, and, quote, fighting world terrorism. Of course, we not only did not defeat terrorism, but in fact multiplied it by 100 or 1,000. And very little attention paid to building infrastructure. A good example of this is, for example, in Afghanistan. There used to be, Afghanistan has lots of rivers, excellent water, but they all flow out of the country. And in the country, in the United States, pays for this, spends more than $300 million importing electricity. And there were two or three dams like Kajaki, Maipar, et cetera, et cetera. These were sort of abandoned in the process. Instead of these being fixed and, you know, made active, they were abandoned. And so the country is a net importer of electricity from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan. And this last winter, there was a snowstorm and it knocked down two of the pylons, the electric pylons. Mm-hmm. It took the electricity, which is privatized now, 2 months to wreck those two and restore electricity. So in Kabul, people did not have electricity for 2 months this last winter.
What do they do for, how do they communicate? What happens to the internet, all that kind of
stuff?
Well,
people have generators.
People have
generators.
Those
with money. And mm-hmm. like our university was never without. We always mm-hmm. have generators. Mm-hmm. So when the public electricity goes off, automatically the generators come on. And we have power year-round, 24 hours a day. But there were many, many people. In fact, I know my own faculty, Afghans, who did not have electricity and would charge and recharge their mobiles at the university because there was no electricity. Mm. So, and of course, the roads, you know, you drive these tanks and military hardware, the dams, the hospitals, the schools, the universities, because both the Afghan government, such as it was, and the international forces all were focused on fighting. And there was little effort and little money spent on restoring, you know, or building the new infrastructure. And the other thing was, I think you asked about refugees. The Afghans continue to be the largest number of asylum seekers as we speak. Very interesting thing came up when they were electing these, appointing the ministers for the cabinet. And the Constitution says, you know, you have to be an Afghan citizen to be a high government official. And so the parliament sort of took this seriously. And what we discovered was many of the people who were nominated for the cabinet positions actually had other citizenships. So including, for example, the current Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Rabbani, who was the son of President Rabbani, the major jihadi leader. This man, who has a lot of property in Afghanistan, is a well-known family, lots of relatives, and, you know, he's... But he had Canadian citizenship, and so he gave it up, and so did some other ministers. So, in other words, you know, Afghans, they try to leave if they can because, again, hardly anyone believes in the country and hardly anyone has any faith in the government to bring peace, prosperity, education, democracy, and so forth.
Well, let me say this. We think of Afghanistan as a failed state, lots of violence, but it wasn't always like that.
No.
You know, it's always been a poor nation, as far as I know, you know, it had all sorts of wonderful things going on.
Yes.
And so what were previous governments like? You know, at one time you had a king, and then the king was, were those earlier governments like?
Yeah, well, I grew up in and finished high school in Afghanistan. I was there under the monarchy, and then I was there for a while with the republic. Yes, you're right. Afghanistan was a poor country. It was an underdeveloped country. But everyone had something to eat. Everyone had a place to go to. And you hardly ever saw so many beggars or so many prostitutes or so many addicts or so many poor people. You know, you hardly ever saw that. It was self-sustaining society, and it was not importing any food. It was producing its own food and sometimes even exporting fruits and vegetables and so forth. And there was peace. There was security. You could travel anytime, any place. No one would bother you. Corruption was not like this. Like now we're number one, number two, and lawlessness, Afghanistan is number two after Zimbabwe. It was, and people had dignity, you know, there was honesty, there was loyalty, the institutions were solid, family, school, the mosque, the school, etc. You know, all of this was fine. And then you had Daoud, the Republican, the king's cousin who overthrew the monarchy in 73. He really tried to move the country forward. He was a modernizer. Of course, Afghanistan had a modernizer 100 years ago, King Amanullah, who gained independence from the Brits. And You know, 100 years ago, this king and the queen was sending women students to Turkey and abroad to go and study. 100 years ago, women had their own magazine. 100 years ago, there was a land reform program, etc. And now all of that's gone. So then, you know, Dawood was overthrown by the communists, and the communists really tried. Their mistake was they were in a hurry, they were ahead of their times, and they used violent means. Then, of course, you had the Taliban, and, you know, where...
And Brzezinski's bright idea.
Brzezinski's bright idea, you know, the Mujahideen, call it blowback, call it boomerang, call it whatever. I mean, we trained the Mujahideen. The CIA trained Bin Laden. Remember, Bin Laden worked for the CIA, mm-hmm. including his secretary who was just assassinated in Yemen 3 or 4 days ago. This was a CIA man. Bin Laden was a CIA man. And most of the Mujahideen who currently have enormous wealth and influence and so forth were all CIA, the Mukhabarat, and the ISI, Saudi and Pakistani. And then, you know, you have... So the Taliban were, in terms of law and order and doing away with crime, it was a wonderful place to be in. It was better than Portland. No crime, none of that. And then, of course, we have the new regime, you know, Karzai, and so forth. So things began to fall apart in a major, major way. In other words, in many ways, people now, when you talk to people, because there's such lawlessness, there's so much crime, there's so much corruption, and there's such a paralysis in the government, people are nostalgic for the older days. And because there are so many divisions, so many factions, you know, and such so much friction, that people are nostalgic for the previous regimes, including the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes you wonder what all this Western... influence and has amounted to? What is it? What has it accomplished?
Well, what it has accomplished is, of course, yes, you have now shopping malls, mini shopping malls.
Wonderful.
You know, yes, you have plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, mm-hmm. But people die from simple diseases because all of this, the foreign goods, consumer goods, you know, technology, plastic surgery, travel.
I think technology seems to do that. You know, like they go for all this kind of the, you know, the glamorous stuff.
Yes, yes.
You know, meanwhile, the soil deteriorates.
Yes.
Water goes bad and all, you know, the basics yes. are ignored.
Exactly. Exactly. So you have these incredible wedding palaces. As you go to the Kabul airport, for example, that you would feel at night, you think we are really in Las Vegas. But then on the other side of the wall there, people are almost starving. Mm. So you have this incredible, you know, stupid condition of a few accumulating all the wealth and power and privileges and the vast majority suffering and or living in the Middle Ages. That's what foreign mm-hmm. intervention has meant.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we say a little about this big incident that happened recently, the case of a woman named Farkunda.
Farkunda. Yeah, Farkunda yes. now has been turned into a verb also. You say, don't Farkunda me, uh-huh. or I'm afraid to be Farkundized. Mm. Yes, this happened on March 21, just a year before the, day before the New Year, the Afghan New Year. And this woman... 27-year-old Farkunda, who came from, you know, an average working class. Her father is engineer and in Kabul, Farsi-speaking, Tajik. She had finished high school. She had memorized the Quran. She knew the Quran by heart, which mm-hmm. is not easy. And she was about to embark on religious studies. And then in Kabul, you know, they have these shrines in Afghanistan. There's a lot of mysticism. You know, you can go to this shrine and you'll become fertile, or you'll get rid of your TB, or you get cured, you know. Or you have these omelets, you know, by the mullahs and religious people. In other words, there's this whole industry of, you know, religious healing or mystical healing.
Kind of like Lourdes in France.
Yes, whatever. So... there's this very famous mosque in Kabul, Shahid al-Shamshira. I can picture it, which has a shrine next to it. You know, Shahid al-Shamshira means the king with two swords. And she used to visit this and then saw these con men who are masquerading as mullahs, religious people, holy people. They can cure you of all of your problems. And will take money from people, and men and women, you know, people are desperate and you can't go to the hospital because you can't afford the fee. the public health has gone to hell, and so forth. And so she began arguing with these con men and say, you're taking advantage of these men and women. You shouldn't do this. You know, why are you deceiving them? This, of course, was a threat to the con men's industry. Mm-hmm. And they said, she burned the Quran. And then initially, this is in broad daylight. Initially, the two or three men said, she's an American. And then when people saw that she's not an American because she speaks, saying in Farsi, I didn't say this. And then the men accused her. She said, she burned the Quran and she's an American. And when she said, look, I'm not an American. I speak Farsi and look at me. I'm so-and-so. And then they said, you're an American agent, which tells you something. This happened in broad daylight in Kabul by dozens and dozens of men conversed. Her video, there were videos, you know, and people taped this, went viral. And you know, she was lynched. She was killed. She was mobbed in the most brutal way. And then when she was still alive, one of these people drove his SUV on her. And then they killed her and then set her on fire and threw her body into the mangled body, into the river, the Kabul River, which is right next to it. This frightened people. It frightened me. And for the first time, I choked up. You know, I was both enraged, I was ashamed, and I was frightened. I said, if this can happen in Kabul here, about a mile from the American embassy and the palace, this could happen anywhere to any of us. But what it did was it frightened a lot of the women. The women in my program would tell me, we're afraid. We can't say this, we can't say do this. But it also emboldened the women. And so it went on in the press, in public conferences, in, you know, meetings, workshops, the press, you know, it went on and on and on. And something very historic happened because women finally said, we have had it with men. And for the first time in the history of the country, and perhaps in any Muslim country, her body was carried by women only from her house to the cemetery, to the graveyard. Mm-hmm. They would not let, this was shown on television live, women, just throngs of women, you know, they carried her body and they were surrounded. And then they were surrounded by the police and so forth. They would not let men near. They said, you are the killer. We don't trust you. Don't come near. Which was amazing. And it has generated a lot of debate in the country, you know. And this is Helena Malikyar's article, I think. I don't know if that's what you're reading. The Afghan-American who writes for Al Jazeera. Excellent commentator. She's wonderful. So, in other words, it really made everyone pause, men and women, to think the kind of country it has become and why women had more freedom in 1920s and then in the 1960s and 70s, but now are muzzled. Mm-hmm. So it has been very healthy. Unfortunately, you know, we lost this woman. But it has been very healthy in terms of generating a serious debate about the women's position and women's condition in the country.
And is that continuing? I mean,
yes. Yes, it's, you know, the Farhunda, as I said, is now part of the lingua franca. It's part of the language, part of the daily debate.
Do we have any more callers on the line? Laurie's on the line. Good morning, Laurie.
Yes, but there was no reason for the United States to invade Afghanistan, and the description you've just given certainly describes that not only did no good come of it, I think things are much worse, and I would also think that your university would be connected to that as kind of a soft power and maybe yes. Propaganda. Also, you have a speaking engagement coming up on the 24th that I think should be mentioned.
Yes, I think in the Northeast, Northwest.
Yes,
yeah, Northeast.
At Baltimore Meeting House.
Yes, yes.
On the 24th, 7 to 9.
Yes.
And for people who would like to continue this or listen
yes.
anew, but anyway, my comment about the university,
yes.
I would just think that would be very suspect.
Yeah, very good point. You're right. I mean, you know, the decision to invade Afghanistan or Iraq was made. There was a lot of commentary on this from a lot of people here. That decision was made actually in the summer of 2001 and not in September of 2001. Mm-hmm. You know, the decision was to invade one of these countries and have an American presence, as you can understand, geopolitics. You know, the U.S. and the West needs to do this.
Let me briefly interject. Tomorrow morning on Fight the Empire, we're going to be talking about this, and the great game continues.
Yes, it does. Anyway, as we can see, we are now on the verge of another hot war. Mm-hmm. You know, the United States placing people in Eastern Europe, and Putin saying, you know, I have 40 new missiles that can really hit you in D.C.
So I just wanted to get that in, but I continue what you were saying.
But this is important. So the United States, it was all this talk about eliminating, getting rid of the fanatics, Islamo, these fanatic fascists, and liberating women, eliminating the drug industry, and bringing peace, prosperity, and stability to Afghanistan and the region. All of these were simply lies that we were told by Bush and Blair. And the lies, unfortunately, continue in some ways, just as today, you know, the United States and NATO are mobilizing themselves, quote, to defeat ISIS, as if ISIS were like, an enormous multi-million well-equipped army. I mean, come on. You know, many people believe that the United States and Europe invented the ISIS because they used up Qaeda and Taliban. And so to frighten the American public, you know, to sell weapons and to justify its own existence. So the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan was for that reason, and we talked a lot about that. As for the AUF, yes, and Samantha Power, I think she's our representative in the UN, American representative in the UN, she, I think, coined that phrase, the soft power. Some people do see us as a soft power, but those who attend the university, like my students, amongst my students in the master's program, we had all kinds of people, fanatics, fundamentalists, even probably Taliban. But by the end of the program, when they saw the program, that this is the American University is non-governmental, non-profit, non-denominational. It's open to all people. And you will see people with long beards and, you know, clothes, and women with, you know, chadors and so forth studying there. The perception would be we are suspect, and I've thought about that sometimes. We talk about it, but we say we have good intentions, and we will not allow ourselves to be used by anybody. So that's our position, and those of us who work there try to live up to that, you know, a free university of free and impartial inquiry and free thinking. It could be used, but hopefully, you know, people would get education and not allow themselves to be instruments of this or that.
Do we have time for another call? Carrie? Harry?
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my
call.
You're
on the air.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Three quick questions. First of all, is Karzai still in politics in Afghanistan, and does he live in Afghanistan?
He lives in the palace, actually, in the compound. He does appear here and there, and he has a lot of followers who are some in the government, some without the government. Although in his most recent interview with the New York Times, he said he has no ambitions to run again in 2019, but he will be 61 then. He wants to be a major player. You know, he comments on all kinds of things. And I think I suspect that he would want to be president again.
Number two.
I also heard that Kabul, a city of 2 million people, doesn't have a sewer system.
5 million people, no sewer system, no regular water system, and no regular electricity, and no regular housing or fooding for the poor.
Oh, wow. I have one last thing. I have an idea for you for construction of student classrooms. In Portland, Oregon, we have this park called Peninsula Park.
Yeah.
And in it, they have this giant gazebo. I was thinking that would be something easy to construct that you could use for classrooms for students.
You mean turn parks into schools or open?
In Peninsula Park, they have this. It's a gazebo. You know what a gazebo is?
Oh.
Uh-huh. It's a giant gazebo.
Yes.
And it'd be easily to be constructed. And it could be used for classrooms.
Well, if you can raise the funds, please raise some funds and send it to us, and we will do whatever you want us to do. Oh. Yes, the country needs classrooms, books, pencils, notebooks, good teachers, buildings, electricity, toilets, etc.
Okay, I think I hear the music playing, and this has been a wonderful hour, very instructive.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Professor Zahir Wahab for being with us.
Thank you.
And stay tuned, because a lot of good stuff coming up on KBOO. And let me just say that tomorrow on Fight the Empire, we'll be talking about this great game and this whole Eurasian geopolitics. You can't understand politics without a map. So stay tuned to KBOO.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 2nd through 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Four stages, 100 performers, including the Greg Allman Band, Galactic with Macy Gray, and Buddy Guy. There will be after-hours performances, shows on the Portland Spirit, and much more. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Make Music PDX on Sunday, June 21st in numerous locations around Portland. Make Music PDX is an event for people who love music and the joyous sense of community that music can foster. Portland will be joining over 725 cities internationally who celebrate Make Music Day, with music played throughout the day and throughout the city. Again, that's Make Music PDX all over Portland on June 21st.